Miami-Dade's sheriff race is one to watch, and so all of a sudden is Palm Beach's. Broward schools may get a new watchdog, and a Keys candidate is under investigation. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup. I'm your host, Tim Padgett. In the next hour, an ace panel of South Florida journalists will help us make sense of what voters face on Tuesday, a million-dollar Palm Beach County State Attorney race Donald Trump may have a stake in, a crowded and competitive Fort Lauderdale mayoral contest, a Miami-Dade sheriff's election, the first in 60 years, a Monroe County election supervisor match featuring charges of election fraud, and we'll ask if newspapers should still endorse candidates. All that coming up right after the news. I'm Tim Padgett. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Well, a lot of you probably feel the only thing creepier than some of the Halloween costumes you saw last night is this year's election. And it has been overwhelming. But that just means it's all the more important to get out and vote, which we strongly hope you already have done or will do this Tuesday, Election Day. Pundit after pundit has called this the most consequential presidential contest in decades. But our South Florida races and questions are pretty compelling, too. In Miami-Dade County, we're voting for sheriff for the first time in 60 years, and Palm Beach County could see its first new sheriff in 20 years. In Broward County, voters may take the extraordinary step of installing an inspector general over their embattled public school system. And in the Keys, the Republican running for election supervisor is herself being investigated for election fraud. And amid all the horse races, there's also a growing debate over whether our newspapers should still endorse candidates. What do you consider the most important South Florida election issues? Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. I am privileged today to be joined by a panel of talented and experienced South Florida journalists to help us navigate those issues. With us is Steve Bousquet, opinion editor at the South Florida Sun-Sentinel, Summer Brugal, Miami reporter for Axios, and from WLRN, our very own Palm Beach County reporter Wilkin Brutus, and our very own Miami-Dade County and investigative reporter Danny Rivero. We will also hear a brief pre-recorded conversation with WLRN's Keys reporter Julia Cooper a little later. Welcome to you all, and just to quickly start, guys, I want to get a sense from each of you of how you're seeing what looks like a pretty significant early voting turnout here so far. Steve Bousquet, we're hearing that Republicans are outpacing Democrats in South Florida's early voting. Is that what you're seeing too, even in a Democratic stronghold like Broward County?
Statewide, the answer is yes, Tim. Statewide, it's very impressive. I mean, first of all, about a third of the voters in Florida, one third, have already voted in this election.
Wow.
4.1 million, according to the Department of State's website this morning. 2 million Republicans have voted early and a little over a million Democrats. That's an enormous advantage. But of course, the Republicans do have an edge of about a million voters in voter registration.
Right. But more than a fifth of Florida's voters are NPA, no party affiliation independents.
Yes,
would you say correct. That this is sort of in this sort of election, a very contested, election where a lot of independents are going to remain fairly undecided until Tuesday, do you think?
I don't think so on the presidential vote. I have a hard time contemplating that somebody could be still undecided
between
Trump and Harris at this point.
Good point.
But the turnout by NPA voters is also strong. About more than 800,000 NPA voters have voted so far.
Wow, those are big numbers. Summer Brugal, what's your sense here in Miami? A strong early voting turnout and perhaps an especially robust Republican early turnout too?
Yeah, I mean, we're seeing very similar trends in Miami, like what's happening statewide. You know, according to some the numbers from this morning that I checked, Republicans here in Miami are outpacing Democrats in terms of early voting so far. The numbers here do definitely mirror and trend statewide numbers so far.
Wilkin Brutus, what are you seeing in Palm Beach County?
Yeah, early voting turnout in Palm Beach County has been quite strong. More than 50% of registered voters, approximately 481,000 have already cast their ballots. So far in Palm Beach County, more Democrats actually have shown up in the polls.
So bucking the trend up there.
Oh, absolutely.
Danny Rivero, the big election story in Miami-Dade County, of course, is how Republicans have been overtaking Democrats so much in voter registration. Couple that with GOP presidential candidate Donald Trump's call to his supporters to vote early in this election, which is quite a turnaround from his past rhetoric.
Right.
And are we seeing a lot more red than blue voters turning out early here?
We are. And I think, you know, it's hard to extrapolate too much from the early numbers because of that shift in messaging. I mean, in 2020, President Trump told people vote on election day.
Yeah.
And they did. They had a clear margin of more voters turning out on election day. And now the message has shifted and he's told people vote early. So we don't know how much of this early vote lead that Republicans do have across the state, including in Miami-Dade, is just people just shifting when they voted.
Because this time it could be Democrats who come out more on election
day. We don't know that.
Yeah. Steve Bousquet, I want to turn to the South Florida elections and issues that are driving that impressive early voting turnout. And one of the most striking ballot questions in Broward County is whether to expand the Office of Inspector General, which watchdogs the county's government agencies, to keep an eye on the Broward public school system as well. What makes this an unusual proposal, in your opinion, and which way do you see Broward voters going with it?
Well, what makes it unusual is that just the cannibalization of government in Broward County and stuff. This is a school board initiative. They want the school board members want this additional oversight to their credit.
Right.
I think, and they've taken too long to reach that conclusion, but they did nonetheless. But the county commission needed to put this on the ballot because it's an amendment to the county charter.
Right.
I think it passes overwhelmingly. In Broward, people like their individual school board members, but everyone knows that the school district as an institution has got a lot of issues.
Right, and a lot of controversies in the past few years, including legal controversies that have brought this on, right. Summer Brugal, we've also got a fairly extraordinary ballot measure, or I should say ballot measures, plural, quite a few of them actually, in Miami-Dade County's fastest growing city, Doral, or Doralzuela, as it's often called for its large Venezuelan population. These are essentially questions about no less than completely restructuring how Doral is run. No, I mean, you and your Axios colleague Martin Vassolo did some really good analysis on this recently. Tell us about what voters are going to decide there in Doral.
Yes, yeah, so in Doral, we have the mayoral race. We have two council seats up for grabs and also 10 amendments, like you said, which could really restructure kind of how things are run. So in the mayor's seat, we have incumbent Christy Fraga seeking her second term and then being challenged by Roxana Garay, who's a political newcomer and a businesswoman. But really kind of going to those amendments, like I said, there's 10 of them that would really kind of shift or give more authority to those council members. You know, for example, we have Amendment 2, gives the council authority to create committees and choose those members. Amendment 6 gives the council, not the mayor, power to select a city manager. And Amendment 3, for example, prohibits the mayor from taking official action on behalf of the city. But what's also really interesting and wanted to point out is Amendment 8 would also remove runoff elections. So that would kind of be an interesting change as well. So those are kind of just a brief overview of those 10 amendments that could really shift those power dynamics in Doral.
Why is this shift coming, though, Summer? I mean, as I pointed out, Doral is the fastest growing city in Miami-Dade County. It's really trying to assert itself these days as a player, you know, with recent decisions to make an opinion on the Gaza war, on the Venezuelan election. Why now is the city suddenly feeling like we've really got to do a makeover of how we run things here?
Yeah, I mean, I can't speak to essentially, you know, maybe right now. I haven't spoken to that yet. But I, like you mentioned, there has been a couple of, high profile decisions that the council has made, like weighing into international affairs and then kind of walking their decision back after a lot of criticism and then also weighing in on Venezuela. So I think in terms of the mayoral race, too, it's really kind of a stance on do we want to see new change and new leadership and give the council members more authority? Because there has been, you know, a lot of people have said that there has been that kind of what some people would call a division between the council and, right. and you know, leadership. So, mm-hmm. So yeah.
Wilkin Brutus, just a few months ago, a lot of people thought the race for Palm Beach County Sheriff wouldn't be all that competitive. Five-term Democratic incumbent Rick Bradshaw looked like an easy favorite, but not anymore. His Republican challenger, Michael Gauger, has made this much more dramatic. How did that happen?
Yeah, absolutely. Bradshaw has been a favorite for many years now. I mean, he's been in office for 20 years, making him the county's the longest serving sheriff ever. That's a lot of experience. But Michael Gauger was his former top aide for 16 years. And there are several issues that have sort of fed into Gauger's momentum. One, Bradshaw has faced many criticism for delays in equipping deputies with body cameras. He does now, but that took many years. Mm-hmm. I've reported on how he refused to supply his deputies with Narcan for opioid overdoses.
Right. Putting him kind of behind a lot of law enforcement in the entire country.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. And two-thirds of the sheriff offices across the state. This year's, it's been quite contentious throughout the several years now. But now the most criticism involves transparency surrounding the $957 million budget.
Right.
There's been a lack of transparency surrounding that budget. And so that has sort of fed into Gauger's momentum in this race.
But Gauger's faced some criticism for going into Bradshaw's health, right?
Yeah, I think a lot of folks have felt, at least voters, to my knowledge, have felt that that's probably below the belt because it has nothing to do with policy concerns.
Exactly. Danny Rivera, we of course have a historic sheriff's election in Miami-Dade County because it's the first here in 60 years, as I mentioned. Remind us about the circumstances behind this and who looks likely to win this contest between Democrat James Reyes and Republican Rosie Cordero Stutz.
I don't think I'll weigh into who's likely to win. I mean, a lot of it does depend on ultimate turnout because both mm-hmm. these candidates, it's a partisan election. They have an R and a D next to their names.
Right.
And however independent voters fall on that spectrum too. But the reason that we're voting for this is in 2018, there was a statewide ballot initiative that passed, and one part of it required all these offices to be elected across Florida. Miami-Dade was the only one that didn't have a sheriff, and that goes into effect now. So we have to elect the sheriff, a tax collector, and a supervisor of elections all in this election for the first time, all of which are very, very important.
Exactly.
Very, very important races.
I would say so, yeah.
And truthfully, whoever does win that race, between Republican Rosie Cordero Stutz and Democrat James Reyes for the sheriff's race, whoever wins that will be the number two most powerful person in the county. Yeah. And that's not hyperbole. They will be an extremely, extremely powerful position. We've seen this in our neighboring counties and Broward and whatnot. Mm-hmm. The sway and the power that the sheriff has, we haven't had a corollary for 60 plus years here, and we're about to get it.
All right. No, as I said, very momentous. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. We're looking ahead to next week's election here in South Florida with a panel of journalists, including Steve Bosquet of the South Florida Sun Sentinel, Summer Brugal of Axios, and WLRN's Wilkin Brutus and Danny Rivero. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Steve Bosquet, the one South Florida mayoral election that really stands out is Fort Lauderdale. Democratic incumbent Mayor Dean Trantalis is facing no fewer than three challengers, Kenneth Cooper, Jim Lewis, and Barbara Stern. This is an important race because Fort Lauderdale really does look to be at a sort of growth crossroads as South Florida's, quote, second city. What strikes you most about this election and the stakes involved?
Well, that's a great question, and thanks. I've covered it closely. We had an editorial on this race in today's newspaper. A flashpoint of controversy in city elections is what some people see as too much development too quickly, even though they're executing a master plan that was adopted about 20 years ago. But it's obvious that the infrastructure in Fort Lauderdale has deteriorated severely. It's a highly flood-prone city, as everyone knows. And every time it rains or every time a sewer line breaks in Flagler Village, I can feel people looking to the sky and seeing a 72-story skyscraper.
Yeah.
I'm saying that hyperbolically. And wondering, there's got to be some connection here. So two people in city government, Mayor Dean Trantalis and City Commissioner Steve Glassman, are the major fundraisers in these races, and they've raised their money largely from real estate and development industries. So they're closely tied to the same interest group that people think is to blame for a lot of the city's quality of life problems.
Yeah. Yeah, and
it's going to be interesting to see what happens.
And I do want to get to that commission race later. Summer Brugal, speaking of Miami, I want to pivot a bit to the question of the all-important Latino vote. This morning, Florida International University released its new Latino poll, and it shows that nationally, 57% of Latinos will vote for the Democratic presidential candidate, Vice President Kamala Harris. That couldn't be in starker contrast to the more local poll FIU released last week that showed 68% of Cubans in Miami-Dade County support the Republican candidate, former President Donald Trump. So when it comes to Latinos, Miami-Dade is going rojo, red. But do you think, Summer, that those really vile comments about Latinos and especially Puerto Rico at Trump's Madison Square Garden rally last Sunday could make some Latinos here think twice?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a good question. You know, I haven't spoken to specifically Latino voters since those comments were made, but I think it's important to note that we have a lot of, Republican local elected officials who condemned those comments. And then we also have, I think a lot of nationally, we have, the Democrats seizing on those comments. And I wouldn't be surprised if that trickles down to Miami. And in terms of talking to local Democrats here, when I did reporting on the local Cuban poll that polled Cuban voters here, they still said that was just a snapshot in time and that they still have been reaching out to all Latinos here in Miami just to get out the vote and to educate them on what they think are the important issues and how they should, turn out the vote. But I think, it'll definitely be up to local voters to decide day of if they haven't voted already.
And we should point out, we do have a very large Puerto Rican voting cohort here in South Florida, mm-hmm. although the larger one in the state is in Central Florida. And I think that's where we're going to see the biggest effect. Wilkin Bruda, speaking of Trump, I want to ask you about the race in Palm Beach County for state attorney up there, not just because of the candidates, but also because of the extraordinary money behind one of those candidates and the donors that have unmistakable connections to Donald Trump. What's this all about?
Yeah, this is a race between Democratic candidate Alexia Cox versus Republican candidate Sam Stern.
Right.
Several wealthy Palm Beach donors who have previously backed Donald Trump have made large contributions to Sam's campaign. Most of that money have gone to
TV his
campaigns.
War chest is now $1.5 million.
Oh, it's a lot of money.
Yeah.
And there were also local tension brewing since outgoing state attorney Dave Ehrenberg refused to support Governor Ron DeSantis's call for a separate state investigation into the recent alleged assassination attempt on Trump in West Palm Beach.
Exactly.
The FBI, Secret Service, and other federal agencies were already conducting an investigation, but that sort of refusal added a layer of tension in the air. And so I think that is also motivating the support for this candidate.
And we should mention Sam Stern's major opponent is Democrat
Alexia Cox.
Alexia Cox.
Yeah,
right.
She's currently the deputy chief assistant state attorney, who was also endorsed by Dave Ehrenberg.
Right.
And another thing I want to say, this is, unlimited terms, and when we talk about the state attorney's office.
Right.
Unlimited terms.
Okay.
And so yeah.
Well, we'll see how all this money plays out then. Danny Rivera, we've also got controversial votes going on in Miami-Dade County, and I'm thinking specifically of Miami Beach. First, we've got yet another ghost candidate situation in the District 106 election for state representative, where Democrat Joe Saunders is facing not just controversial Republican incumbent Fabian Basabe, but also Saunders' estranged aunt, Mo Saunders Scott, who a lot of people believe is on the ballot only to sap away votes from Joe Saunders. Will it succeed? And just as important, Danny, will Frank Artiles' conviction last month help to discourage this whole ghost candidate frenzy in Florida?
Yeah, it is a very strange election. There's Joe Saunders on the ballot, Mo Saunders on the ballot, his estranged...
Well, Mo Saunders Scott, because of a judge's ruling that she couldn't just call herself Saunders.
So there's Mo, Joe, and No, which is the other candidate, which is... the incumbent Republican, mm-hmm. Fabian Basabe.
Right.
It's a difficult thing to talk about. Like, will this work or not? Because what's different than other races where these ghost candidate things have come about is Fabian Basabe, the incumbent Republican, has a lot of name recognition in his district and is not necessarily good.
Yeah, a lot of baggage.
It's
yeah.
a lot of baggage. And he did win that seat, which has been pretty solidly blue for decades. Mm-hmm. He won it in 2022 when Democratic turnout was at the floor. Like, no one showed up to vote.
Right.
He won it. And he's had controversy after controversy. He was, you know, denied a place at the Pride Parade after voting for the so-called yeah. don't say gay bill. Mm-hmm. He's had a string of allegations that he's assaulted people. He's under investigation in Los Angeles for allegedly mm-hmm. raping someone in 2003. He strongly denies all of these claims. But it's a lot of baggage.
But in spite of all that, can Mo Sanders Scott, as I said, sap away enough votes from Joe Saunders, her estranged nephew, to help Basabe actually come out on top again?
Maybe. I mean, the absurdity of this storyline did receive a lot of publicity, and it's yeah. just kind of laughable. Like, South Florida politics, what even is this? But it has been a Democratic district yeah. for a very long time, and okay. The question now is, was 2022 an aberration?
Right. Okay. We're going to take a quick break here, and then we'll be right back with our election panel of journalists Steve Bosquet, Summer Brugal, Wilkin Brutus, and Danny Rivero. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. So let's pick up where we left off before the break with our election panel of South Florida journalists, Steve Bosquet, opinion editor of the South Florida Sun-Sentinel, Summer Brugal, Miami reporter for Axios, WLRN's Palm Beach County reporter Wilkin Brutus, and WLRN's Miami-Dade County and investigative reporter Danny Rivero. You can call us with your election perspectives at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. I want to start here with a brief conversation I had with WLRN's Keys reporter, Julia Cooper, about the unusual circumstances of an important election in Monroe County, the contest for election supervisor. So, Julia, the Democratic candidate for Monroe County election supervisor is former state representative Ron Saunders. The Republican candidate is business executive and Monroe County Republican Party treasurer Sherry Hodes. This is an unusual contest, though, because Hodes is currently under state investigation for electoral fraud. Tell us why.
So this stems from an endorsement that happened in the primary race coming from the local Republican Party. They took a vote to approve this endorsement that was tied to a $20,000 campaign donation.
And this vote was held last April, right?
Yes. Yeah. So basically what happens now is a formal complaint was filed by another local Republican in Key West that basically said this might not have been a lawful endorsement and disbursement of funds because not enough members of this Republican committee were present at the time for the vote.
And is it correct to say the current investigation against Hodes was in effect ordered by Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, himself a Republican?
So because our local state attorney recused himself from the case, Governor DeSantis stepped in and okayed the investigation to be passed off to a different state attorney in a different jurisdiction.
And who is that state attorney?
State Attorney Amira Fox from Collier County.
Yet despite this investigation, the race between Hodes and the Democrat Saunders will go as planned next Tuesday, right?
Absolutely. So while this investigation is ongoing, it's not looking like it's going to wrap up before November 5th. And so the election is going to go through without us having the results of the investigation.
So hypothetically, if Hodes were to win on Tuesday and then be charged with electoral fraud after the election, how would that affect her victory and her assuming the position?
The charge itself, you know, if convicted, would be a third degree felony offense, and it could be punishable with jail time. And so we'll ultimately see how the judicial powers choose to hand down the results of that.
Julia, what does this controversy tell us about the state of the Monroe County Republican Party and the infighting that seems to be going on there?
I'm hearing from a lot of people over and over that these local elections seem to be getting nastier and nastier, and this infighting is something that people don't really want to be dealing with right now, but is an unfortunate reality of this political season.
Are we seeing any of that on the Democratic side down there as well?
I think with this political season, we're really seeing the Republican Party having a lot of infighting, and the Democratic Party doesn't have some of the same kinds of infrastructure that the Republican Party does. And so at least this race, we're not seeing the same kinds of things happening.
Does the Democratic candidate, Ron Sanders, believe this GOP dysfunction is helping his chances? You report, for example, that Republican Monroe County Sheriff Rick Ramsey has now endorsed him.
So I spoke with him a little bit, and he said that he believes this ongoing investigation, what is happening on the Republican side, you know, may be of huge concern to the voters, and you know, they'll take that to the ballot boxes.
And we're really not sure how Hodes believes this investigation affects her chances because she declined your interview request, right?
Yes.
Thanks, Julia.
Thank you so much, Tim.
That was WLRN's Keys reporter, Julia Cooper. Steve Busquet, moving back to Broward County, I know another important election you and the Sun Sentinel are watching, as you mentioned earlier, is the Fort Lauderdale City Commission District 2 race. And again, it feels similar to the mayoral election in the sense that it seems to speak to that Fort Lauderdale growth crossroads we mentioned earlier. Incumbent Steve Glassman faces two challengers, Charlotte Rodstrom and Chad Van Horn. And we're talking about who represents the city's really prime real estate, right? Downtown, Las Olas Boulevard, the beach. Tell us more.
Absolutely. Yeah, this is District 2. Big race. And I will say the Sun Sentinel editorial board endorsed challenger Charlotte Rodstrom, who's a former city commissioner. Glassman is also closely identified with real estate and development interests. He has a political committee that got a $50,000 contribution. That'll get anybody's attention.
Yeah.
Within close proximity of a vote, and his vote in favor of a skyscraper downtown that's being litigated. I have to say this, Steve Glassman is very well known, very approachable, very diligent in terms of, you know, asking questions. He's a studious commissioner, but his development record is pretty controversial. And so it gave us strong concerns and pause on the editorial board.
Yeah.
But I think with two opponents, any incumbent who has multiple opponents, believe it or not, that's better for the incumbent because the multiplicity of challengers split the anti-incumbent vote.
Right. Great
so
point.
So that could actually help Glassman win re-election next Tuesday.
Great point. Summer Brugal, here in Miami-Dade, I wanted to ask you about two issues quickly that you've been on top of recently for Axios. The first is this somewhat stunning decision by Miami Beach City Commissioners to suddenly nullify a question on the ballot there about a 1% food and beverage tax for homeless and domestic violence services. The other involves a couple of politically high-profile Miami-Dade school board elections. Can you walk us through those, starting with the Miami Beach controversy?
Sure, yeah. So like you said, and I want to say my colleague Martin has been really covering the Miami Beach issue, and so he's been keeping me up to date. But essentially, it's pretty much what you said earlier this week. The council members voted to rescind a referendum that would have created a 1% tax on food and beverages to fund services for people experiencing homelessness and for domestic violence victims. And they did this despite the fact that voting had already been underway.
That's
and
what really
people had cast their ballot.
That is what really strikes me, that they can rescind a question on a ballot after voting has already started.
Yeah, that is a question that a lot of people had. And actually, you know, Commissioner David Suarez was the one that spearheaded this effort, and he's saying, you know, it would impact and negatively affect small businesses while benefiting real estate interests. And, you know, he and another commissioner, you know, did acknowledge the timing of this, but they said, you know, he wasn't super aware that it was on the ballot until last month. And then just kind of after that happened I think it was within 24 hours. You know, the next day, a group of residents filed a lawsuit challenging the vote and mm-hmm. asked a judge to allow voting to proceed. And okay. And I believe that hearing was this morning. And I know Martin is downtown, and I think it's expected this afternoon. But what's interesting here is that Miami Beach voters in 2021, I believe, supported the tax in a straw ballot question. So that also kind of raises right. questions as to all of this.
Now, really, really quickly, these two Miami-Dade school board elections that you think are of note. Can you just very quickly tell us about those?
Sure. These are runoff elections. We have District 7. We have incumbent Mary Blanco, who was appointed by DeSantis in 2023 and endorsed again by him this year. And she's facing challenger Max Tuchman, who's a former teacher and tech entrepreneur. And then we also have in District 3, we have Joseph Geller, who's a former state rep and longtime chair of the local Democratic Party, and former school board member Martin Karp. What's interesting here in District 7 is that DeSantis gave fewer endorsements this year than he did in 2022, but Blanco was one of them. I think this race really kind of shows that voters are split on the board's, in recent years, the board's push to more conservative policies. Go ahead, sorry.
No, so I'm just going to say a lot of culture war fingerprints
Correct.
on these elections. Wilkin
Correct.
Brutus, there's a Palm Beach County Commission election that I know you and I wanted to make sure we mentioned, not just because of those vying to win it, but because of the gentleman who's leaving it, right? Mac Bernard, tell us about that.
Yeah, just a quick heads up for local residents in Palm Beach County. Mac Bernard was the only Haitian American on a Palm Beach County Commission. He was termed out after 8 years, and he's heading back to the legislature this time as a senator, having served in the House before becoming Palm Beach County Commissioner. He's going to be the second Haitian American in the Florida Senate,
State Senate, right.
State Senate. Former Democratic Senator Daphne Campbell was the
First.
first. And so, for folks who don't know, in Palm Beach County, Mac Bernard was known for advocating, championing housing development, especially during the housing crisis. He spearheaded the $200 million bond initiative in Palm Beach County, which was a major story. Played a key role in the Vanderbilt University being placed in West Palm Beach
Exactly. That's
recently.
been big news up there
Massive
recently, right?
news.
Yeah.
And
So,
yep, go ahead.
yeah. No, so that it, it's it, that is very interesting that he's going to be now going to this to the state Senate. Danny Rivero, here in Miami-Dade County, we also have two ballot questions of special note. One involves Watson Island, which you refer to as the Afghanistan of Miami politics. I can't wait to hear your explanation on that one. The other has to do with Wi-Fi. Tell us about Miami's Afghanistan first.
They let me keep it in the story. Let's just say that I was happy about it. But these two ballot items refer to proposed developments on Watson Island, which is where the current Jungle Island is. And I called it the Afghanistan of Miami politics and development because for decades, there's been empires, real estate empires that have wanted to develop this thing. They've made promises they're going to develop this thing. They've
And so Watson Island is the graveyard of corporate
right.
empires, the way Afghanistan is the graveyard of
Exactly.
political empires
Exactly. Like
throughout
everyone
history.
wants to conquer it. It hasn't been conquered so far.
Right.
But there is some hope in some quarters from the supporters that this time will be different. Basically, Watson Island has MacArthur Causeway down the middle going to Miami Beach. On the north side, there's one development. On the south side, there's another development. They're technically separate on the ballot, but they're kind of conceived together, and they would be connected if they both pass. It'd be luxury condos on both sides, some retail, some offices. And then in exchange, on the north side, the developers say they'll give 13 acres that are under a lease agreement right now. They'll give it back to the city, and they'll build a public park that's on the water, and it's going to be very pretty and beautiful. And we promise that it's actually going to happen. That's the promise.
Okay. And the Wi-Fi question.
And the Wi-Fi question, there is a Miami-Dade County wide ballot referendum, and it asks residents, do you support adding more public Wi-Fi connections? And I think, all indications and expectations are this is probably going to pass. It's like asking people if they want popcorn. But it is connected to kind of in the background here, the state of Florida is getting over $1 billion from the federal infrastructure law for expanding broadband. Just a couple days ago, the federal government gave the thumbs up and okayed Florida to move forward with that. A
Right.
lot of that's coming to Miami-Dade County.
Right.
And it'll go specifically to underserved areas, to rural areas and some inner city areas, and they're going to have a lot of money. They will likely put more money, but this will just give them more. The voters told us to do this.
Exactly. We're going to take another quick break here from the discussion with our election panel of journalists, Steve Bosquet, Summer Brugal, Wilkin Brutus, and Danny Rivera. When we come back, we'll discuss a contentious election topic that's on a lot of people's minds right now. Should newspapers endorse candidates? This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. Up to now, we've been discussing next week's elections here in South Florida with an esteemed panel of local journalists, including Steve Bosquet, opinion editor for the South Florida Sun-Sentinel, Summer Brugal, Miami reporter for Axios, WLRN Palm Beach County reporter Wilkin Brutus, and WLRN Miami-Dade County and investigative reporter Danny Rivero. But for this final segment of the show, we're going to pivot to a question that has frankly erupted in just the past couple weeks. Should our newspapers endorse political candidates? The issue has taken front and center since last Friday when the Washington Post owner, Amazon.com billionaire, and Miami resident Jeff Bezos said that national daily would not endorse a presidential candidate. The Post has since seen 250,000 readers cancel their subscriptions in protest, but the Post is hardly alone in rethinking this long-standing U.S. political tradition. Do you think newspapers should endorse candidates? Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Steve Bosquet, let me start with you because this month your newspaper, the South Florida Sun-Sentinel, said it will not be endorsing a presidential candidate. Take us through the reasoning behind that decision.
Yes, thank you very much, Tim. We didn't endorse for president or in the U.S. Senate race, and it wasn't our decision locally. It was made about 2 years ago by the corporation that owns the Sun-Sentinel and our sister paper, the Orlando Sentinel. Mm-hmm. So we're not endorsing in those two races. I did not agree with the decision. I was powerless to change it. We announce it at the top of the opinion page every time we run a complete list of all the candidates we're endorsing. I have to say, I'm the person who gets the emails and the phone calls from voters about our endorsements.
Right.
And our endorsements in down ballot races are more appreciated and prized than ever. As a matter of fact, we, due to staff limitations, we did not endorse candidates in some of the smaller cities. About 25 cities have elections in Broward alone this cycle.
Mm-hmm.
That would be another 150 candidates to have to evaluate. We didn't have the bandwidth or the staff resources to do it. So we only endorsed in the larger cities. And we're getting angry emails from readers, and I understand their frustration.
But what was the Sun-Sentinel ownership's rationale for not endorsing presidential or U.S. Senate candidates?
It was not explained to me as clearly as it could have been, but one of the reasons was, look, people don't rely on a local newspaper to guide them in a presidential election. They do in local and state elections, so let's focus our strength where it, you know, where it's most appreciated. That was the rationale given to us.
But as I mentioned, the Sun-Sentinel and the Washington Post are not alone in this decision. The Los Angeles Times is not endorsing a presidential candidate either, for example. Why do you think we're seeing this shift in attitude away from media endorsements of candidates?
I think that it alienates some readers, or it's perceived to do so. What happened at the Washington Post was an atrocity for a number of reasons, leading with the fact that it's so close to the election.
Yeah.
And then everyone knows that the owner, Jeff Bezos, has business interests before the federal government, before the White House, and will have.
Yeah,
That's an out-and-out conflict of interest.
The optics were not good. Summer Brugal, I look, for example, at your former employer, the Miami Herald, and I see that in two of the three Miami congressional elections, the editorial board simply did not make an endorsement. The paper also just had to rescind its endorsement of incumbent Republican state representative Vicky Lopez because of new questions about unethical conflicts of interest involving school bus camera legislation she just co-sponsored. As of today, I have not seen a presidential endorsement from the Herald, and I don't know if there will be one. But the bigger question is, do you think voters here in Miami also here feel that endorsements are still useful or not?
You know, I think, you know, it's important to mention that the Herald also didn't endorse a presidential candidate in 2020.
Exactly,
and only
yeah.
endorses
yeah,
candidates
right.
if they interview both candidates. So I do think that's something to note. In terms of if voters feel that it's useful, I know that I've talked to individuals, you know, family members, especially, you know, older family members that I think are very used to looking to newspapers for those endorsements. But I think, I think younger voters could look elsewhere. But I don't necessarily know if we could say that people feel that they're not useful or they are useful. I think, time will tell as we continue to move forward.
Wilkin Brutus, I know you have some thoughts on this question as it relates to your county's newspaper, the Palm Beach Post, right?
Yeah, I was a former journalist for the Palm Beach Post, and I've always had mixed feelings about endorsing presidential candidates, for example. But I do also understand the importance of having a social template to provide voters who may be confused about who to vote for, mm-hmm. especially if reporters are investigating or reporting on county judges, for example, whereby it's quite difficult for a resident to really know exactly what a judge does.
Yeah.
And so in terms of serving as a template, it's a good thing. It may serve as a conflict of interest if you're, to Summer's point, only interviewing one particular candidate and not the other.
Yeah.
I think if you're going to stop endorsing a candidate, you want to do that much earlier than a few weeks before the general election.
Right.
So the optics just doesn't sit well.
Danny Rivero, this week you and I were discussing Jeff Bezos and the Washington Post controversy, and you made an interesting point about how Bezos' decision seems to reflect newspaper ownership going back to the old days of protecting commercial interests instead of promoting civic interest. What concerns you most about that?
You know, and I actually do think, and I feel that, in discussing politics, we don't look at enough to history as a uh-huh. like a roadmap or a way to understand what's going on. But it's true. In the early 1900s, I mean, there was media empires that were owned by the same people that owned the industrial empires, mm-hmm. and they aligned those interests very much, right?
Yeah.
And in the case of the Washington Post, there's clear commercial interests at play there. The mm-hmm. same with X, which is now owned by billionaire Elon Musk.
Elon Musk.
He's very much putting his thumb on the scale to benefit himself. He has multi-billion-dollar contracts with the federal government. He wants
Donald Trump's strongest supporters.
He wants his guy to win.
Yeah.
And we are, kind of entering into a different era because a lot of billionaires are flexing their muscles in that. And that happens, to expand it a little bit. There's been a massive, shift in the way that media operations.
Yeah, I mean, today it's more typical for a newspaper owner to be a hedge fund than Katharine Graham.
Well, no, exactly. I mean, and it's across the media landscape. It's with the TV stations, radio stations, and a lot of that consolidation. Mm-hmm. It focuses us more on national politics, less on local politics. It's an issue as a, someone that works for independent media. I feel like it's an issue.
This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. We're discussing next week's election and also whether newspapers should endorse candidates with journalist Steve Bosquet of the South Florida Sun-Sentinel, Summer Brugal of Axios, and WLRN's Wilkin Brutus and Danny Rivero. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Steve Bosquet, one of the interesting points Jeff Bezos made in his defense of the decision not to have the Washington Post endorse a presidential candidate is that recent polls show the public already thinks the mainstream media are too biased. Is that a valid concern, or is Bezos, as you sort of suggested, just looking for an excuse for what many people feel was his caving to Trump because Trump is suddenly saying he's going to go after his enemies, like media who endorse Kamala Harris, if he wins next week?
I think the perceived liberal bias in much of the nation's media is real. It comes up all the time.
Yeah.
I think it's become more prominent because of what you have now. You have echo chamber news outlets. People watch MSNBC knowing they're going to get the news packaged a certain way and framed a certain way. And if you watch Fox News, it's going to be pretty much the opposite. We hear it at the Sun Sentinel. I think it's also... There's some validity to the fact that as people increasingly turn to online news sources, the distinction between straight news reporting and opinion, and the straight news columns of the Sun Sentinel, in my judgment, and in the Herald and most other papers, they strive to be scrupulously free of bias. But I think it's not as evident when you're reading everything online or in your phone or in your lap. Right. I think that's a factor there.
Right. We have a caller on the line, John from Delray Beach. John, welcome to the South Florida Roundup. What's your perspective on this question?
Well, 2 points. One, it's really inappropriate not to endorse if one candidate chooses not to be interviewed, because it could be used politically as a candidate who's maybe a late entrant or someone who's not a credible candidate could jump into the race, not come to the interview, just so you won't endorse the more credible candidate.
Right. And John, I should mention you are a former commissioner in Delray Beach, right?
That is correct. The second thing is, it's not just about who reads the endorsement in the newspaper. Obviously, we know that newspapers have suffered pretty significantly in terms of readership. But what candidates do is they use the endorsement on their mail and emails and their various communications with constituents or voters. So that becomes a very important thing. But to a point that one of the members of the panel said, we need to start doing these things earlier.
Yeah,
it's often with early voting now and with absentees being out almost 2 months, to get an endorsement 3 weeks or 2 weeks before an election is really very, very much less valuable.
Right. Well, thanks very much for that perspective, John. We appreciate it. Summer Brugal, in my own commentary for WLRN.org this week, I said Jeff Bezos did leave the unmistakable impression that he'd let a major U.S. daily be, let's face it, bullied by Donald Trump. And I wonder if he thought at all about how that looks in the community he hails from, Miami, where so many people, like his Cuban father, have fled authoritarian countries and regimes that do bully newspapers into submission. Should this be worrisome here?
You know, I can't speak for Mr. Bezos, but you know, like the other panelists have said and other reporters have said, you know, the appearance of the bullying, I think, is worrisome, especially when I think it was Steve that just commented on sometimes readers might not be able to distinguish between what is written by a reporter that tries very hard to remove bias and what could be written by the editorial board or somebody who's making, an endorsement. So I don't know if it's worrisome in terms of, you know, Bezos' impact on South Florida voters in terms of Miami. But I think if we're going to, you know, have the conversation moving forward, I think it's fair to say that, you know, people in the public could be very concerned about the either real influencer or even the perception of influence.
Yeah. Wilkin Brutus, let me ask you the same question. Palm Beach County has a very large Haitian population, a community that has also had people who fled political persecution of independent media, including murders of journalists in many cases. Do you think the optics of Bezos's actions are troubling for them as well?
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's always been a mistrust of the media ecosystem. You can see it when people are reading news, random videos on WhatsApp, for example, and you have to check your parents to make sure that they're reading the accurate thing.
Yeah.
And from a macro perspective, there's been an unintended consequence when you've democratized the media space. For example, podcasts are increasingly the favored place to go for candidates to spread their message. And so misinformation has become far more difficult to be checked. And that's what we're facing right now.
Yeah. Danny Rivero, final word here then. Do you see newspaper candidate endorsements becoming a thing of the past now?
I don't. I mean, it shouldn't. Because I get calls every election from my mom. Hey, who did the Herald endorse for the circuit judge? You know, like that's really important. Those are like really, really, and we, you know, most people don't know what's going on. But for the presidential race, I think most people's minds are honestly made up at this point.
Yep, you're probably right. Sadly, that's all the time we have. I want to thank today's great election panel of journalists, Steve Busquet, opinion editor of the South Florida Sun-Sentinel, Summer Brugal, Miami reporter for Axios, WLRN's Palm Beach County reporter Wilkin Brutus, and WLRN's Miami-Dade County and investigative reporter Danny Rivero. Thanks very much to you all.
Thank you, Tim.
Thank you.
Thanks
for having us.
Yep. Finally on the roundup, I recommend you take a break from all this election stress this weekend and celebrate Day of the Dead, or Dia de los Muertos. And few places do this ancient Mexican and Latin American tradition better than Fort Lauderdale's Florida Day of the Dead celebration. It will hold the 15th edition of that event, complete with fantastic Mexican food and spectacular ofrendas, or offerings to the dead, tomorrow starting at 3 p.m. And in the spirit of that tradition, WLRN's Jimena Romero, who's originally from Mexico, shares with us here a calaverita literaria, a satirical poem in honor of Los Muertos.
Estaba Carmelo comiendo un pedazo de queso, cuando de pronto se le atoró en el pescuezo. Y en un 2x3 la muerte se apareció, y muy contenta al cementerio se lo llevó.
That was about a guy named Carmelo who was eating cheese when, all of a sudden, he choked on it and Lady Death took him happily to the cemetery. Calaveritas have that way of mocking death or communing with the dead, which is what Dia de los Muertos is all about. And that's a reminder that this weekend also kicks off Fete Ged, the Haitian version of the Day of the Dead holiday. For more information on where to celebrate Fete Ged in Miami, visit HaitianTimes.org. That will do it for the South Florida Roundup. If you missed any part of the show, you can always search for the South Florida Roundup podcast in the NPR app or wherever you listen to podcasts. The show is produced by Jimena Romero with help from Polly Landis. Katie Munoz is our director of original live programming. Mateus Sanchez is digital editor. Sergio Bustos is WLRN's vice president of news. The vice president of radio and the show's technical supervisor is Peter J. Mertz. Richard Ives answers the phones. I'm Tim Padgett. Have a great weekend, and thanks for listening. Gracias, merci, obrigado.